This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. And Taylor, we got a chance to talk to today's guest, tape with him last night. Dino Ebel, the third base coach of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And I got to tell you, in the midst of that was the first time when I was absolutely like, we got to get back on the field. I was dying because I just loved the conversations that we got to have with Dino about, you know, coaching third base and what it's like to make a decision when Cody Bellinger's running and Mike Trout, you know, calling to give him a hard time. It was just a fun, great baseball conversation.
Yeah, I think it really, really was one of the first ones that I felt transported onto the field. He was a good guy. I didn't know anything about him, but yeah, great conversation. Really cool to just hear the little insights on how he works with superstars to try and get them to be better players. So I think the listeners are really going to enjoy this one, and we'll probably be jonesing for some baseball as well.
Yeah, and this is the start of what we're going to refer to as Coaches Week. We're going to be talking with Wayne Kirby, longtime coach of the Baltimore Orioles, coach of the San Diego Padres now. I'll be mining him for stories from personalities and moments in his career, and we got others that we're working on as well. Today we'll also be talking with Anika Orek, the author of a new book, The Incredible Women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. It's a tremendous book. I'd recommend it to anybody, and she has a great story to tell. We start today with some awful news. Arizona Diamondbacks center fielder Starling Marte announced Monday on social media that his wife, Noelia, has died of a heart attack. He posted on Instagram, "Today I go through the great pain of making public the unfortunate death of my wife, Noelia, due to a heart attack. It is a moment of indescribable pain. On behalf of my family, I am grateful for the expressions of esteem and solidarity in this difficult time." And I'm sure so many players have reached out to him. Starling Marte, someone very well liked and respected by his peers. Bartolo Colon, the longtime pitcher, told R. Marley Rivera that he still hopes to pitch in the major leagues. He's 46 now. He has not pitched in the majors since September 2018, but he is not considering retirement yet. The quote that he gave to Marley, "If I had the opportunity, I would play in any league, go anywhere. If any major league team wants an old man, I'm available." The governors of some states important for Major League Baseball, New York, Texas, California, all expressed openness on Monday to the idea of professional sports being played in their respective states sometime in June. So that's a hopeful development for baseball and its effort to get back on the field. I will say this, it made a lot of calls on Monday with sources, and the more that I hear about the ongoing talks between the union and Major League Baseball, there hasn't been a lot of progress to date. The clock is ticking, although I do think they'd take anything they could get, a 60-game season, a 30-game season, a tournament, to at least try to play and move the game forward. Of course, the proposal that was put out by Major League Baseball to the union last week was about an 82-game season. Before we get to Dino and Anika, check out the latest episode of the Woj Pod. ESPN senior MLB insider Jeff Passan joins Adrian Wojnarowski to discuss the parallel paths that the NBA and Major League Baseball are taking and trying to play this summer, how dramatically different the union and league relationships are in the two sports, the impact of the star players' role in labor talks, Adam Silver and Rob Manfred, and what's at stake for these sports in the future. Find it wherever you get your podcast. Anika Orek is the author of the new book, The Incredible Women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Anika, welcome.
Thank you, Buster. Thanks for having me.
It's great to talk with you. This is a history, but at the heart of it are these wonderful illustrations. And I mentioned to you in a message that your cartoons remind me of those I've always loved in the New Yorker. But your research is incredible and detailed. This was a project long in the making, yes?
Yeah. It could have been a lot longer. I had so much fun with it. But yes, about 3 years from beginning to end.
Now, your grandfather was a cartoonist. He passed away about a decade ago. Tell me about his role in your life.
Well, gosh, I think he probably, he's every role in my life, but yeah, he was a cartoonist and a newspaper columnist, and he just very witty, clever, warm in his writing and in his being, but he also loved baseball, and baseball was always on at my grandparents' house, and he played when he was younger, his father played and coached, and it was just always around, and I think because I loved everything he did and everything he was about, I just naturally loved baseball and the sounds of baseball. And then eventually, you know, here we are. It's kind of filtered its way into my life, as has everything he's done, really.
Can you sort of describe that? Like, you know, what are things you remember, your early memories of baseball and sharing that with your grandfather?
Oh, sure. Well, one thing that just always stands out, and I think of him every time I hear it, anytime a leadoff is walked, I can hear him saying, "God, dang it, you never walked a leadoff guy. Yeah, geez." You know, he's like, it was like it had never happened before. He would just curse it. But, you know, my earliest memories that I love were just, they would have the ball game on the radio. Lon Simmons was calling the Giants games at the time, and my grandparents lived in the Bay Area. And they had a big deck out front of their home in Fremont. And we would just sit out on the deck in the summertime, and my grandma would bring hot chocolate. And we would just sit there and listen to the game. And then every once in a while, he would tell me some stories, or, you know, he knew every, he just was like a walking, not even an encyclopedia, a walking library, I guess you could say. And I would always, you know, later I would call him if there was some sort of strange call, or, you know, what happened there? And he just knew, you know, oh, that's the infield fly rule. And that, you know, he would explain whatever had happened. But later, you know, I grew up in Salt Lake City. My parents moved when I was younger. They worked for the airlines, and they used to call, you know, this is before the at-bat app or anything like that, and we didn't get the Giants games on the radio. So our knowing of what was going on was a single phone ring on the house phone if the Giants scored. And then I believe it was two rings if the other team scored. I can't quite remember, but there was definitely a code, and it was not it was not accurate, or, you know, you didn't really know what was going on, but it was just really fun, and just kept us connected. And I spent all my summers with my grandparents and weekends, and, you know, I spent probably more time with my family in the Bay Area than the family that we had in Salt Lake City. But actually, I know I did. But yeah, it was just always there. And the sound of the game was around before I ever really understood what was happening. So when I finally understood the game, it was just, yeah, just nostalgic. And I just loved it. I loved the sounds and the sights.
How did he impact your path as an illustrator?
You know, I didn't realize that he had until, you know, he passed away. And then a few years later, just a couple years ago, we had to move my grandmother into a memory care facility. And I sort of inherited these big boxes and tubs of different things that were in their garage. And it was so fun going through them. But he used to make us homemade birthday cards. He would take an 8.5 by 11 sheet and fold it in half lengthwise and draw a little cartoon on the front and some clever thing on the inside. And I don't know what happened to mine, but I found a big stack of them that were made for my grandma. And I didn't know. I pulled them out, and my very first thought was, I don't remember making these. And then I realized that I didn't, he had. So I think whatever was in his style and his nature in drawing, I guess it just obviously very much influenced me, because it's very much how I draw today. So I think it was just all those days spent looking over his shoulder, which would have driven me nuts, but he was so sweet. He didn't care. If some little kid was watching me draw every line, I'd tell him to scram probably, but he was very patient, and he was always, encouraging me to draw as well. So I think I just picked up on it naturally.
Now, you did an interview on NPR's Only a Game. I would encourage everyone to go and find that. It was a terrific piece that they did on you. And I was fascinated by the idea. You mentioned that when you want to tell a story, your instinct is to use illustrations to help you do that. Can you just explain that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess just because I draw and I love story, it's almost like an abbreviated thing. My brain just automatically, when I hear a good story, the first thing I think is, how do I draw that? Or, oh, I want to draw that. Or I'll be out and see a funny interaction between two people, or, you know, a guy on the train, and I just think, I want to draw that. Because there's so many things that you can do with line and an image that tell a story without words. Little details on, you know, a button on someone's jacket or something can just say anything. But there's also things you can do with illustration that can tell the story that a photograph or words can't, or they do differently, I should say. Kind of the way that animation does for film. You can exaggerate things. You can take things to a whole other world. You can do things with story that you just can't do with other mediums when you are combining your imagination with whatever drawing skill you have. And it takes a while to get to that point, I guess, when you're able to take what's in your head and put it down on a piece of paper. But once you get there, that is just the most fun you can possibly have when what you're thinking actually comes out, because then you're able to just become a conduit or a filter for stories. I draw all the time and I will, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'll laugh at my own drawing or giggle at something because I don't feel like I did it. I feel like it's got a life of its own the second it comes out of my pen, and it just becomes its own thing. And I'm just the facilitator, you know? So that's also fun. I just have to be careful not to express that too much. People think I'm nuts, but that is the most fun.
Now, it was you looking over images of baseball, of sports, that inspired your choice of subject here, the Incredible Women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been drawing and illustrating baseball for a handful of years now. Just kind of for fun, I started illustrating some baseball stuff for a story I was working on. I was doing story and character work for animation. And it just kind of took on a life of its own. And I've been able to illustrate baseball, you know, just work in that realm. And I do a lot of ballpark drawing, where some people will keep score when they go to a ball game. I sketch. And I was putting together a lot of my ballpark drawings and sketches for a self-published little book project I was working on, just to have something to bring to this animation expo that I attend. And as I was going through the drawings, it occurred to me that other than like a few drawings of fans, there were no women in any of my drawings. And it was never something at the forefront of my consciousness. Women in baseball, you know, just the fact that there were women players, or, you know, it was like I knew somewhere, but it never really was a thing that I was conscious of, which I'm embarrassed to say, but at the same time, just in general, I just was never so aware of being a woman, but until I started doing this, and also because I had the incredible privilege of drawing a lot of the time from the broadcast area. And, you know, I have a very fortuitous friendship with the Giants broadcaster, John Miller, and all the, you know, it's mostly men up in that area as well. But they're all just like so supportive and nice. And I never really had any moments where I just thought, whoa, I'm a woman up here. You know, so it was sort of this weird, stark realization. And the first thing I thought was, there's got to be good stories about women in baseball, because that's what I work with. I am inspired by stories. I'm not inspired by photographs or, you know, I'm just the stories. And lo and behold, after I went to the only go-to story I knew of, A League of Their Own, and then dug a little deeper, just below the surface, there are some incredible stories. And I just got addicted. I thought there's got to be more. And I got to talk to these women, and it just kind of became borderline obsessive, but so much fun. And I found really great stories to work with.
And you learn that they have an annual reunion of players and family members. And you told the story in that interview that I heard about, you know, almost being like a wedding crasher and going there and trying to get to know them and gain a comfort level with them. And part of your effort involved a lip sync contest. Can you tell that story?
Yes. Yeah. My 5 minutes of fame. Well, as you said, it is, you know, it's a very intimate, gathering, this annual reunion. Apparently you can just go, I don't know, according to the internet. So I did, I spent some of my advance money and went to the reunion, but these people get together every year, as they have since the early 80s. So I showed up, and as the producer of that show said, so it was like crashing a family reunion, which is exactly what it felt like. But so I had been to one, and then there was an event at Yankee Stadium honoring the women of the league that I sort of some somewhat helped put together through my friend Jean Afterman, who wrote the foreword to this new book, The Incredible Women. And she put together a thing to honor these women. And while we were there, a woman asked if I would participate in the annual lip sync contest the following year. They needed some contestants. And I don't even know that I actually said yes. I think I said something along the lines of, I would love to, but, and then she just said, great. I didn't prepare really. I practiced this thing in my Airbnb, but I put together a kind of a pantomime using photos to Debbie Boone's You Light Up My Life. And I had a whole suitcase of photos of, like, it was ridiculous. I had no idea what I was doing. But anyway, and I, like I said, I had no time to practice. And this thing I put together is so me. It wasn't just me standing up there lip syncing a song. Of course, I always have to overdo it. I get something in my head, like I make this grand production, but then I don't have any time to practice. So there's all these photos upside down that I have to remember where they are and lift them at the right time. And I don't know how I did it. I actually had like a complete out of body experience, but I somehow pulled it off and the room just exploded and I won the lip sync contest. But it was the most interesting thing because it wasn't that I had been, you know, shunned or no one had been nice to me. Everyone was really nice. I just was not part of that intimate group of people that gathered every year. But after this weird lip sync production to You Light Up My Life, people were coming up to me the rest of the weekend and introducing me to their families and tell, you know, this is the girl I was telling you about, or people who I had never spoken to were coming up to me and talking to me. And it's the weirdest thing, but that was the thing that sort of brought the wall down a little bit. And I was able to talk to a lot more of these women and their families, and it just made everything a lot easier. So, yeah, I don't know what lesson there is to be learned from that, but but I learned it.
Yeah, you threw yourself into your work for sure, and it gets you an entry into talking with these players. And I'm curious, as you went through the process of researching the book, was there a player that you really enjoyed getting to know either directly or through other stories?
Oh gosh, there are several of them that I've really enjoyed getting to know. There are a few that are just dear to me, and I don't know that I even could explain how or why, but through their stories and just their nature and the time they spent. There are several, but you know, I hate to even say one because there are so many wonderful ones, but Jean Fout is sort of a hero of mine. She's the only professional baseball player that's thrown two perfect games in a career, man or woman. But she just kind of her life experience and what she went through and her perseverance and just her grit and her sheer talent. She's kind of a genius on the mound. But she's almost entirely deaf. And there was a point where I was supposed to fly to her to interview her. And there were some complications with that. And we were going back and forth using the TPY system. And so I had asked if I could just interview her at the reunion a few months later. And she had several people there wanting to interview her at that point, I guess because she's kind of, you know, she's kind of a big deal. And she had held off on everyone waiting for me to get there to talk to me. And I just found that so wonderful and endearing. And we had the greatest conversation. And she also was so funny, just got really into telling me some stories, stood up from her chair at one point and started yelling and acting out this story. And, you know, she can hardly hear a thing, but she's just still with it. She's still showing up to the reunions, even though she can't hear anyone when they talk to her. And I don't know, I just think that says a lot. And she sort of missed out on some things because of her situation when she played. And I'm just very endeared to her for a lot of those reasons.
I'm so jealous in going through your book because I can't draw anything. And I was thinking, I've done a couple books, and I loved the way that you use the illustration to illuminate details. For example, I was amazed by how the size of the ball that they use changed constantly. And after hearing, you know, players talk about, oh, this surface feels a little bit different and how thrown off they are by that. I don't even know how they were able to play with this base. It was a softball originally, and then as it gets smaller and smaller, how they were able to adapt. That was incredible.
Oh, my God. I know. I mean, you know, anyone can say what they will about the league or why these women shouldn't be inducted individually into the Hall of Fame, or it wasn't really baseball. which, first of all, anyone who says that, I got to tell you, read my book or find something. Find something else so that you can to understand that this was real baseball. But the athleticism itself was incredible. But imagine, you know, imagine playing soccer and starting with something the size of a beach ball and then ending with something the size of a grapefruit. Yep. You know, not even just every year, sometimes mid-season the ball would get smaller. And their ability to adapt, and then pitching style, you know, it started as a softball league halfway, almost, you know, maybe three quarters of the way through the very first season, they changed it to the All-American Girls Baseball League and had already made drastic changes because they just realized it wasn't competitive enough. And these girls were so good. And a lot of the girls, a lot of the women had grown up as girls playing just baseball. So to start with softball was a struggle, which I think a lot of women are dealing with today. But to be able to adapt to those things without warning, you know, they'd show up to spring training. It was like, by the way, the base paths got a few feet longer and the ball got a little bit smaller. And now you're pitching sidearm. Now you're pitching overhand. You know, it's just like, I think that just proves how amazing they were, especially for that time.
Exactly. Before we go, some rapid fire, coolest compliment that you've gotten about the book.
Oh my gosh. I think one of the, well, I've gotten handwritten letters from some of these women. That's just amazing because they all got a copy. And one woman said, you captured my experience perfectly, which just, let's just say there were tears. There is crying in baseball. I guess that would be the most meaningful.
You mentioned your friendship with John Miller. I got to know John when I was covering the Baltimore Orioles, and he was still the Orioles broadcaster. How did you get to know him?
The magic of Instagram, I guess. He's a prolific Instagrammer, but he grew up in Hayward, California, and somehow there was a comment on a post of his. My boyfriend actually saw a post of his and tagged me in it because it had an image of his father playing the gut bucket, which I don't know if anyone knows what this is. It's basically a washtub turned upside down with like a broomstick and a rope, and it's turned into a makeshift stand-up base. And when my family used to have like just fun party jam sessions in the back room of my great aunt's house, my grandfather would play the gut bucket, and my boyfriend's a musician. So I was always trying to tell him what this thing was, and he's like, I don't know what this is. So he saw it in John Miller's post, and I commented that Ray Orach played a mean gut bucket. Well, Ray Orach was, my grandfather was a local columnist in the paper, the Hayward Daily Review. So John Miller grew up reading my grandfather's column and wow. Recognized my name and went to my page and saw that I was illustrating baseball. So, he reached out to me through Instagram and invited me to a game and to the broadcast booth. And I think when I woke up from passing out on the ground, I agreed. but that was a handful of years ago, and they've just become like family to me. He and his wife and his family are just wonderful.
And Sarah Langs and I, in a conversation on the podcast yesterday, we started talking about favorite home run calls. What's yours?
Oh, well, I mean, it's got to be Adios Pelota by John Miller. I do love the old Russ Hodges Bye Bye Baby, but I think my favorite has got to be the Adios Pelota. So many memories tied with that. So many goosebumps.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and Sarah's mother grew up a San Francisco Giants fan, and I think Sarah has a little bit of that in her, so she'll greatly appreciate that for sure. Anika, thanks so much for your time. I love the book. I'd encourage everyone to go and find one. And good luck. I'm sure you're going to be doing a lot more baseball projects after seeing how great this one is.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Dino Abel is the third base coach for the Los Angeles Dodgers. And Dino, I just in preparing for this interview, I looked this up today. You batted 1,000 in AAA in your career. You don't see a 1,000 batting average very often. Bruce Bochy has a 1,000 batting average in the World Series. He told us about that recently. So congratulations on that.
Well, thanks, Buster, but not too much I can brag about on that end of it. Back in those days when I was playing in the minor leagues, I was more of a utility guy, an up and down guy from A-ball, double-A, triple-A. I remember that. It was in Albuquerque, and those were the good old days.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So I'm going to mine into your stories and about what the challenge is for a third base coach. First, I wanted you to tell the story that you told me last spring about in your last spring with the Angels when you, of course, are the coach for Mike Trout, who's going to go down in history as the greatest player of his time, maybe the greatest player ever. And you know, in the spring of 2018, I think it was, you guys had looked at some of his defensive metrics and you saw ways that you felt like you could get better. And you took that to him. Now, a lot of the stars that I've covered in that situation, they absolutely would have blanched and they would have been like, what are you talking about? I've won the MVP. I've done everything. What do you remember about Mike Trout's reaction?
Well, the thing about Mike Trout, as we discussed that a few years ago, is like every spring training during the off season when I was with the Angels and I was the outfield coach, he'd always challenge me. I challenge him. You know, when you got the best player, you know, in this generation telling you as a coach, you know, how are you going to make me a better outfielder? Then, you know, I did my homework and, you know, I got some information on him, you know, playing center field. And the one thing that, you know, I read, you know, here and there, and I still read it, that he's never won a Gold Glove. And that's a chip that Mike has on his shoulder. And, you know, I brought it to him. You know, we got some stuff upstairs from the analytical department and they were just looking at his first step. And we matched him up with Tampa Bay, Kiermaier in center field. And, you know, you can talk to Mike Trout. The one thing I've, you know, known over the years being with Michael was, you know, you can talk to him, you can tell him, you can, you show him, but when he sees it on paper, I think he digs into it more. You know, now he's like seeing it that it is the real deal. And the one thing that he needed to work on was his first step. So, you know, I got with him during spring training. Here I'm with one of the best players in the world, and we're working on first step, coming up with drills, you know, balls that are hit to his left, right, behind him, short line drives, high fly balls to the wall. And that's what he took to heart. So day one spring training, we got out there, and by midseason, you know, all-star break, he went from being in the middle of the pack to, you know, one of the top five outfielders in baseball on his first step. So that's something that, you know, we as coaches try to get our players better, and Mike just took it to heart. And to this day, he still continues to work at it. And I know in his heart that he wants to win a Gold Glove. So, you know, he just got to keep working hard at it.
You said that he challenged you. I'd never heard you describe it that way. How would he challenge you to help make him get better? I mean, what way would he express that?
Every spring training, it was either in base running, stealing bases, arm strength. You know, I always brought it to him. Him and I got a great relationship. We're really close. And, you know, I would just come to him and say, listen, everybody knows that, you know, you have all the tools, but they're saying that your arm is below average. So one spring training, we took it to heart. You know, he started getting into the, you know, the long tossing, throwing footballs. He wanted to show everybody that he can improve his arm strength, which today he's got a plus arm. So every spring he would, and I was ready for him. He would come to me and he's like, all right, Dino, you know, what are we going to do this year to get me better? And that was the thing that was challenging for me. And it was fun. And once I showed him on paper, once we went over it, you know, he bought in and he would go from there. And then that's who Mike Trout is. And he's one of the best. And, you know, he just wants to get better day in, day out. When he gets to the park, he's got one goal in mind. He wants to get better and win. That's the thing that, you know, I remember being with Trouty all those years.
And he's almost scientific about it. You're old enough to remember this, but when Magic Johnson was with the Lakers, we'd always hear about every offseason he would go into his workouts and he would try to get better at one thing. Like one offseason, he worked on his free throw shooting, which wasn't great when he went to the NBA, and then he got better. And then he worked on that little junior sky hook that he shot, and then he worked on his three-pointer. I never forget having a conversation with Trout about the high fastball, which for a couple of years really confounded him. It is still the place where pitchers try to attack today. And the way that he talked about it, because there are players, if you bring up, especially someone as accomplished as he is, if you bring up something that he not necessarily as dominant is, they're bothered by that. There's a self-consciousness to him. And I was just impressed by how he was like, yeah, and this is what I'm trying to do. And he, it was so thoughtful in the way that he went after it.
You're exactly right. And now that you mention that, I remember him at the end of the year, that year when he had those strikeouts and everybody was saying that he can't, you know, he can't hit the high fastball. And he looked at me on the last game of the season and he said to me, wait till next year. You're going to see a different Mike Trout at the plate. And by God, he started taking those pitches. And you said it. I mean, when he has a chip on his shoulder and he wants to prove to people that they're wrong, that's what he does. And I still remember to this day that he said, you just watch the next year. You watch what they're going to say about me laying off that high strike or me hitting that high strike. And he came back and cut down on his strikeouts and had more walks.
All right. What did you learn in your first year coaching with the Dodgers about Cody Bellinger? What jumped out at you?
Well, this guy's another guy that for me, when, you know, I was asked the question last year, you know, what's the difference between Bellinger and Trouty? And there's not too much, there's not too much room there. Bellinger's a superstar. He's got all the tools. He can run, he can throw, he's got the power, he hits for average. So it's all there. But Cody's another guy that, got great work habits, comes to the park every day in, day out, wanting to get better. You know, he is a guy that you want in a batter's box. He wants to be in the batter's box. He told me, what I was amazed about is, you guys know, this guy, is everyday outfielder for us in right field. And then, you know, he just comes in the first, never takes a ground ball in spring training. Doing his outfield thing, wants to win a gold glove in the outfield. And all of a sudden, Dave comes to me and says, hey, I talked to Cody. We're going to put him in the infield, 4 or 5 days from now, start getting him some work. And you know what? He came in there, took 7, 10, 12, 15 ground balls and threw the ball to second base, footwork, and he was ready to go. And that game, the first game at first base, he's fielding ground balls like he's never left first base. So what an athlete, what a tools player, fun to be around. And I'm telling you, you guys know, and you know, it's no surprise in the baseball world, this guy's going to be a superstar.
How much of a feel did you get for how he and Mookie would be defensively together? Because I had Buck Showalter once said to me that Mookie Betts was the best right fielder he's ever seen, especially in terms of the ground he covers in front of him.
Well, yes, he's right. And I saw Mookie a lot, being with the Angels in the American League. But having those guys, the brief time that we were in spring training and saw him out there, working on drills, throwing the bases, I was so pumped. And hopefully keep our fingers crossed to where we can see him out there, as this season, if it gets going. But what a pleasure as a coach, and the fans are going to love it. I mean, if anything falls in center or right center or down the right field line, definitely the hitter is going to be, pumped, because anything that has some air in it, it's going to be caught.
All right. Coaching third base, what's the most challenging situation for you, the most difficult play for you in making a judgment?
Well, I would say, doing it for all these years, I think, getting down the line and trying to let the play develop. And the most important thing for a third base coach, what makes his job easy, is when a player runs through the bases. So, we try to be aggressive. We want to get a good secondary. Balls hit, especially to a guy who has a plus arm, moves well, footwork coming in. If an outfielder to me is going left and right, we got a pretty good chance of, it's going to be you could score on the play because the accuracy might be, not as good as he's coming in. But I think that the most challenging play, I found out in my career at third base is the contact play. The infield's in, got a runner at third, and there's a low line drive hit to the left fielder, center fielder, right fielder. And on a contact play, as the guy at third is going, when the ball's put in play, he's crossed over. So he might already have like a step and a half, 2 steps going forward. And now that ball's hit, exit velocity of 100+, and the left fielder's in shallow or he's playing average. And now by the time that third base, the runner on third base gets bagged to get back to tag, that ball's already in that, that outfielder's hands and momentum coming in. That's the most challenging play for me over the years at the major league level.
What is I've enjoyed asking a coach, third base coaches, this question through the years. What's more challenging, a really slow runner, really fast runner? And I've been told by a number, and it surprised me when I initially heard it, that the faster runners are more challenging.
Well, yeah, because I think the below average runner, they really work hard on getting good secondaries and anticipating, especially with two strikes, with two outs. You know, they know they're not as fast, so they got to get the best jump and turn inside the base, cut the angles better, where a fast runner might say, you know what, I'm so fast that I know I'm going to score on this. So that's what I'm talking about, running through a base. So, you know, again, if you have a Bellinger, a Trout, or a, you know, plus speed at second base and the ball's hit in the outfield, it puts so much pressure on that outfielder to make a perfect throw. And depending on where they're playing in that inning or what the game situation is. But, you know, again, it's for me, I would rather have a fast runner at second base doing all the right things of doing the base running the properly way. But again, the slower runner is going to be more in tune of trying to get the best jump and cutting the angles to try to score because he knows he's slow.
Who's the best base runner you've ever seen?
Ooh, that's a good one. I mean, Bellinger is ranked up there. The slowest base runner with the best instincts that I've ever been around in my career, I think I'd have to give it to Albert Pujols. This guy anticipates, this guy knows the situation. He knows the outfielder's arm. He knows, he's almost like a coach out there. He knows when the ball's hit, but this guy works so hard. You know, the last couple of years with all the injuries that he had, he would just go base to base. But he still, you know, there was a time, I think, in 2018 where he stole third base standing. So these are things that Albert worked on, when he was with the Cardinals. I think one year he led the team in stolen bases. He stole 19 bags and got caught once. So very good instincts on the bases. Torrey Hunter was really good at that. But Bellinger ranks up there. In my career is one of the best base runners I've been around.
Okay, in your time coaching third base, give me your best send that you ever had and give me your worst send. And I'm just talking with professionals through the years, it's always the worst one that they remember the most.
I remember every time when a guy gets thrown out at home plate, that I put that in my back pocket. I like a Josh Hamilton throwing out Howie Kendrick at home plate, or I think the best send for me over the years, and it might have been last year where we were in a 0-0 ball game, top of the seventh, in San Diego, and it's a pitcher's duel, and Chris Taylor's on first, 3-2 count, two outs, he's running on the play, and the ball was hit over the shortstop's head. The ball did not get to the warning track in left center field, but Chris Taylor can run a little bit. He was coming full speed, and you know, I noticed that the shortstop for San Diego wasn't Tatis at the time. The farther he went out, the for me the accuracy is going to be a little bit off. So when I saw the shortstop go out farther than he was supposed to go get the ball from the center fielder, I sent Chris Taylor, and he ended up scoring when the catcher missed the ball at home plate, and we won the game 1-0. So that was a pretty good play that I remember from last year. Another one, I think, was on ESPN. We were playing the Cubs in the Chris Bryant game one was at right field, game two at third base, game three in left field in a 3-game series at Dodger Stadium. And there was a shallow ball hit to him, Chris Taylor on second base in a game tied, I think it was, with one out. You know, I was a little bit more aggressive with one out, hit a bullet to Bryant. And I saw Bryant's footwork kind of like stumble. Or not stumble, but kind of wasn't in the proper position. So I sent Chris, and he ended up scoring. That ended up being the winning run. But the worst of them all last year of all my career coaching third base, minor leagues and big leagues, was last year against the Angels. Two outs, bottom of the ninth, Dodger Stadium, we're down a run. Bellinger at second base. Kike Hernandez he's up there to pinch hit. He hits a one-hop bullet to Cole Calhoun, going to his right. Now, granted, you know, I came up with the Angels. I had those guys. I know Cole's got a plus arm, but going to his right, I knew that if he makes this throw and it's on the third base side up the line, that Bellinger is going to be out. And when that ball was hit, and, you know, anticipating, like, I'm an infielder, an outfielder, before it's hit, where the outfielders are, pitch by pitch, your count, all that stuff goes through my head. And there it was, a bullet to right field, Cole going to his right, makes the great footwork, gets his footwork proper, fires a bullet all the way to home in the air, up the third baseline, and bellies out. So we end the game on that. I still can't sleep. It still bothers me.
Well, and I'm curious, too, because you say you had Cole Calhoun, and I know his personality. He likes a little dig. Did he say anything to you subsequently?
Oh, yeah. They were all over me the next day. But the one that really got into my head was, in a good way, you know, about an hour, hour and a half after the game, I'm driving home and the phone rings and it's Mike Trout, and I pick it up and he's like, got you. So we had a laugh at that, but I told Cole the next day, you know, I said, Cole, you know, right now, if that's the same situation tonight and we're in the same spot, that ball's hit to you. He goes, I know, you got to send him. I said, I know, with two outs, bottom of the ninth. I said, that might be the only hit, the only chance we score. And if you don't make a perfect throw, we're going to tie or win this game. And he laughed, and we got a good chuckle out of it. But, yeah, that play still haunts me.
Yeah, Ramon Laureano, remember that incredible throw he made from the warning track, double play, where he was against the Angels, and he threw out – well, yeah, of course you remember this, right?
Well,
he threw out EY Jr., Eric Young Jr. at first base. And Cole Calhoun, yep. I guess after he made that throw, he stopped – Laureano said, hey, just take it easy, man. Just take it easy, because it was such a cannon. Curious, how often, as third base coach, how often would you guess that signs get messed up? In other words, whatever's related to you as you're going through the signs, how often, because it's rapid fire and you are moving, how often for you is that difficult to translate?
Well, it's a process. You know, I spent a lot of time on giving signs and during spring training, even during the season. Again, I was told many, many years ago by, I feel, the best third base coach in the game. And you know, this name, Joel Mafitano. And,
yep.
I was privileged enough to have Preston Gomez with the Angels and, as an assistant to the GM. And we would always talk third base. So I had different signs with different players. Still to this day, I got different signs with different players. It's just about communicating. I feel, as a third base coach, when a manager puts on a pull-it sign, if it's either a bunt or hit and run or safety squeak, whatever it is, you know, it's my responsibility to make sure that player knows the signs. So I spent a lot of time during spring training and during the season. You know, again, I know guys are watching, coaches are watching me, players are watching me from the other side trying to pick signs. So I'm really cautious and, you know, about my signs. And if I feel something doesn't look right, I might the next day or the next series, I change them. So, yes, it's important. And as a third base coach, when somebody misses a sign, I never blame the player. I've always said this. I blame myself, because, you know, we spend all this time in hitting cages, taking ground balls, but really not enough time on giving signs and making the player understand what the signs are. So that's one of my biggest pet peeves. If when a player misses a sign, I take it to heart and I go to that player, and then we come up with a sign. So next time he gets it, he's going to get it. So that's how I feel about giving signs.
So you're coaching third base and a base runner runs through the stop sign and he gets thrown out at home plate. You, as the coach, how do you handle that?
Well, first, you know, never again, always treat the player like how you like to be treated. So I wait until either the next day or, you know, pick a spot during the game when, you know, when it's time, maybe that same guy got a base hit or hit a double, hit a home run, get him on a good spot, and then communicate with him like, what'd you see there? Where was I? And, you know, sometimes it is the third base's coach's fault, where I might be in a position, but when he looked, I was in the wrong spot. So that's another key point for me, communicating on where they want me and where when they pick their head up and they look, I better be in the spot where they're comfortable on, because it happens so fast, Buster. As you know, you see the game so fast at the major league level, and the guy's trying to score, and once he looks up and he's used to you being in a certain spot and you're not there, you know, and then all of a sudden he's already by you, and you put the hands up, he's by you. So again, that's for me is on my fault, on my side. So I get with that guy right afterwards, or, you know, take the next day and find out what the problem was.
You know, you're so respected by players. And so maybe you don't even have to get annoyed by this, but as a writer watching the sport, something that would always drive me crazy would be, if a guy got thrown out at home plate, and then when they came up from the slide after being called out, they stared down the third base coach. I don't know. You know, you've seen it. I've seen it. I don't know if you've experienced it. I'm not worried about the names so much, but I'm curious about when that happens, because I was like, come on, you're really going to throw the third base coach under the bus? How would you handle a situation like that?
Well, I think it's more emotional at the time. You know, nobody wants to get thrown out at the plate, or especially I think the times you see that is like when a guy really gets thrown out by, you know, 10, 15, 20 feet, depending on the outs, the situation of the game. You might be up 7-8 runs in the sixth inning or seventh inning and, you know, no outs or one out, and you try to be aggressive. You send a guy and he gets, you know, thrown out by 10 feet at home plate. So, yes, I have seen that. But I just think if you build that relationship and you communicate with the players, you know, hey, I tell them up front every year, Buster, and, you know, you could ask our guys this with the Angels and Dodgers. If they get thrown out at home plate, it's my fault. And I get with them. And sometimes you're going to make mistakes, and sometimes you're going to be more aggressive. But, you know, knock on wood, so far that hasn't happened. But I think if you build that relationship and the players trust you, and, you know, they watch, they're sitting in that dugout and they see you send guys constantly. And there's times where they probably in their minds are going, oh, you can't send them. And you all of a sudden, because I'm down the line, I see something go wrong or the footwork's not there, and I send them and they score. I think that's where you get the respect of the players. And once you have that and they understand where you're coming from and you're on their side, I think that's a key point for a player-coach relationship.
You know, listening, it gets me excited to have baseball again. I can't wait. I appreciate you taking the time so I can talk to folks like you.
Thank you so much, Buster. You know, every time I see you on the field, and I enjoy talking to you and talking like this baseball. I hope keep our fingers crossed. We get the players and the owners get together and get this thing going, and we'll be back on that field sooner than later.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. First up, Jason Amico writes in, who are some of your favorite sidearm pitchers from baseball history and why?
Dan Quisenberry was, when I was becoming a baseball fan, he was front and center. He pitched, of course, for the Kansas City Royals. He was the closer. He didn't throw that hard, and he was just so different, and he was so successful that I know playing wiffle ball, I would always try to emulate him. In recent years, I've always Brad Ziegler, who retired a couple of years ago, I've always enjoyed talking with him, and his backstory is incredible, how he basically was told, look, and he was stuck in the minor leagues, look, if you don't adjust, then your career is probably going to go away. And that's how so many sidearmers develop. Peter Moylan, another one who, you know, most recently, I think, pitched for the Atlanta Braves, Kansas City Royals. He's such a good guy, too. You know, keep in touch with him. But those are some of the best sidearm guys I've seen. And I love to watch the old video. I know Walter Johnson isn't necessarily seen as a pure sidearm guy, but man, you look at the video from when he threw, and he was viewed by his contemporaries as being the hardest thrower of his time. That would have been a difficult at bat for a right-handed hitter to see a right-handed sidearmer coming in hot.
Shout out to my guy Darren O'Day as well.
Yeah.
PK Steinberg writes, and PK's got a lot of ideas for the podcast. We are, you know, if this goes on and we have no baseball to talk about, maybe we can break down everyone for every team. But he writes, and would you consider identifying one all-time most iconic hit for each major league team? Any single hit stand out to you without giving it a ton of thought right now, Buster?
Yeah, just off the top of my head, and as someone who grew up a Dodger fan, I was thinking about that. You could go back to the 1955 World Series, but the pivotal moment for that game, Game 7 against the Yankees, that was a catch by Sandy Amoros as opposed to being a hit. I was thinking it's got to be the Kirk Gibson home run from 1988.
Okay.
I was thinking back through the Dodgers years, you know, Stan Musial. I think, you know, he might have been considered – one of his hits for the St. Louis Cardinals. But on the other hand, you had David Freese in Game 6 of the 2011 World Series. And by the way, that game is being replayed on ESPN tonight. That would be a candidate. That's an interesting idea, PK. If this continues to drag on through June, then maybe we'll check back with you on that.
Good deal. Last one for today. Eugene Kottman at The Huge says, Eugene's been watching a bunch of Hank Azaria's Brockmeyer to fill in the hole in his heart for the lack of baseball. But he wants to know, he says in episode 2, Brockmeyer says that the owners won't allow him to make any real changes. You have discussed changes to baseball to make it more appealing to the younger fans. Are the owners reluctant to change? And if not, then who is slash what is? You talk about this a lot, Buster. What are the forces at work that are preventing real radical change in Major League Baseball right now?
In this case, it's the players, and it's the players' culture. You know, they don't want to be sped up in the box, which is something I think the owners would really want. Any changes that are made on the field have to be run through the Players Association, and in recent years, the players have not really been that open to change, although I would say a lot of the players I spoke to really liked the use of the microphones that we had during that all-access week, and I do think that when baseball returns, that'll be a part of it. And Hank Azaria is just, he's amazing. Like, it's incredible. When you look back at his career, the range of his work, tremendous.
Could be a good guest candidate for the podcast, maybe.
Well, we had him on once.
Oh, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll have to go back and listen. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter, everyone. Thanks for writing in.
That's it for today. My thanks to Anika and to Dino and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.